failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. My name is Dean Becker. And earlier this week, the Alliance of Canadian Reform Organizations and the University of Ottawa Criminology Department put together a symposium, the International Drug Enforcement Counter Symposium, a Canadian response to USA drug policy. This was a gathering of experts from around the world to counter the, quote, information being brought forward at that same time at a DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration of the United States symposium, which was being held in Montreal. First, we hear the opening remarks of Barrister Kirk Toussaint, who is the acting chair of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association Drug Policy Committee.
On behalf of the sponsors, the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, the University of Ottawa Department of Criminology, Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and Normal Canada, I want to thank our expert speakers for graciously agreeing to come today and to share their benefit of their decades of experience. As many of you know, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration and the RCMP are today putting on their own invitation-only private conference just down the street. We invited them both to send representatives to this symposium in the hopes of beginning a dialogue on these important issues. Unfortunately, they chose not to attend. That is regrettable, because one thing we need to make clear, and I think dialogue is the best way to do it, is that in many ways we share the same goals as the drug enforcers: safer communities and schools, a reduction in criminality, the elimination of organized crime's involvement in the drug markets. Where we differ is how to achieve those goals. Here today we have ex-law enforcement officers, judges, policy experts, civil libertarians, academics, and a member of Canada's Parliament, all in attendance to discuss drug policy and the critical need to open a dialogue about a fresh approach. The theme of the day is, can we talk? And the goal is to open a dialogue about the ramifications of U.S. drug policy hegemony. Now, hegemony is a complicated term. It's susceptible to many meanings. In fact, there have been books written on the topic. I use it to describe a phenomenon whereby a dominant force spreads its policies throughout the world. I believe that U.S. drug policy is such a phenomenon. So, for example, last week we saw reports of the U.S. influence on Mexico's domestic drug policies. 10 days ago, the Mexican Congress passed a reform bill that would have removed criminal sanctions entirely for possession of small amounts of currently illegal substances. Last Tuesday, a spokesman from Mexican President Vicente Fox's office called the bill, quote, an advance, and pledged that President Fox would sign it. On Wednesday of last week, the United States weighed in, urging, and I quote, Mexican representatives to review the legislation urgently to avoid the perception that drug use would be tolerated in Mexico and to prevent drug tourism. End quote. U.S. Embassy spokesperson Judith Bryan also said that the U.S. government wants Mexico, and again I quote, to ensure that all persons found in possession of any quantity of illegal drugs be prosecuted or be sent into mandatory drug treatment programs. End quote. A few hours later, President Fox refused to sign the bill. In Canada, we have our own examples of U.S. hegemony. Each time Canada begins a dialogue about making progressive reforms to its marijuana laws, representatives from the U.S. begin to make noise about border slowdowns and increased security. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration has indicted and seeks to extradite political activists Mark Emery, Michelle Rainey, and Greg Williams for alleged marijuana seed sales, even though none ever set foot on U.S. soil. And the new Conservative government's crime plan, including its provisions to impose mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes, is unfortunately all too familiar to our American experts.
Mr. Toussaint noted that the DEA refused to attend the counter-symposium, and it should also be noted that U.S. Secret Service agents were posted outside the DEA symposium to keep out unauthorized journalists. Next up, we hear from Professor Diane Riley, a senior policy analyst with the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy and one of the founding members of the International Harm Reduction Association.
Merci, Boris. Merci, Boris. I think... Bonjour. Thank you all for coming this morning on a Monday morning, and I hope that this is as interesting for you as it is for all of us who work in it, and I hope by the end of the day that you will be able to help us in our worldwide campaign to end drug prohibition and the U.S. stranglehold on good policy. I speak to you today because, first of all, as a Canadian, I'm concerned that our country, which is always the kinder, gentler, freer country in the world, is in danger of losing all of that. And I think we have to work very, very hard and be vigilant to ensure that that does not happen. I also speak to you today in the capacity of my role as a policy advisor and researcher and also as a professor. But I also bring more than 30 years of experience in drug policy in every region of the world. Sadly, more than 20 years of experience working in the area of HIV/AIDS in every region of the world. And five long years on the board of the United Nations AIDS program. I'm concerned that drug prohibition, the results of U.S. hegemony around the world, its exportation of its morals, not only to do with drugs, but also to do with sexual morality, and therefore its ban on condoms and funding of condoms, or lack of funding of condoms, I should say, that it's been exported around the world, and it's one of the worst policies of the 20th century. And I hope that we will not carry it too far into this century. The results of this policy is that we have drugs everywhere. It is easier for children to buy crystal meth and crack cocaine than it is to get marijuana, than it is to get alcohol, than it is to get much, much better, less harmful substances. And the result has been a catastrophe. But the illicit drugs are illicit or illegal only by accident and the virtue of racism. The licit drugs are there primarily because they're promoted by vast multinationals, many of the companies owned by U.S. I have before me some audiovisual aids. You will notice a bottle of beer. Alcohol is the main drug of choice around the world. 80% of alcohol drinkers are beer drinkers. The majority of domestic violence relates to alcohol. I need say no more. Next to that, a packet of tobacco. The carcinogens in tobacco, as you well know, cause worldwide problems. And the epidemic of tobacco use is such that it is becoming one of the world's leading killers. This, again, a legal drug promoted. Next to that, one of my personal favorites, chocolate. Fortunately, few ill effects other than the calories, but nonetheless widely used. All of these, I might add, psychoactive substances. Next to that, pharmaceuticals, antidepressants, which a goodly portion of the world, especially in North America, are dependent on. And next to that, one of my personal favorites, again, caffeine, which the NIDA reports have just shown to be, as one would have guessed, the main gateway drug. Kids are getting hooked on caffeine based beverages, and that's the way it goes. No surprise there. But imagine if all or one of these was banned tomorrow, what would you do? What would you do to get your fix? Now, in Canada, we've been blessed with some good examples of sensible policy. We were able to get syringe exchange. Myself and colleagues were able to start those in the mid-1980s in Toronto, and they're now in place throughout Canada. We were also able to have some success with medical marijuana, but then under U.S. pressure, we started to buckle. As a result, we've had a decade of dithering from our last government, and I fear we'll have a decade of withering from our present government. We have dreadful problems with gang-related crime related to drug prohibition and the black market. The level of HIV in our native populations is skyrocketing, and we stand to be in a future where our natives, like most First Nations around the world, will be wiped out by HIV/AIDS as related to injection drug use. Injection drug use and the spread thereof itself a direct result of prohibition. And of course, our prisons are already crowded. The new drug legislation being introduced will crowd them even more. And of course, HIV in prisons is 10 times the rate outside prisons. And we know there are documented cases of it being transmitted within prison and failure, absolute refusal by corrections to introduce syringe exchange in prisons because it sends the wrong message, the message being tied to drug prohibition. Internationally, we have a huge black market that fuels crime and violence worldwide. And the main concern I have is the HIV pandemic, which worldwide now is being driven by drug injection. The majority of HIV/AIDS cases in Asia, Central Asia, and Central and Eastern Europe are related to drug injecting. This sprang up as a result of the closing of the opium dens. It sprang up because drugs become more refined in order to defy prohibition, and as a result, you get injection rather than the much safer modes of use that come before that. But as my colleague Stephen Lewis said earlier at my international conference in Vancouver, what is really, really the issue here is the lives, the millions that are already infected and dying of HIV/AIDS. The face of AIDS in the world today now is a teenager. Many of those are drug users, increasingly so. Stephen Lewis describes his situation as weariness beyond weariness. In my case, having worked extensively around the world, but especially in Asia and Central Asia, I describe it as despair beyond despair. This, as Stephen Lewis put it last week, is our unfolding apocalypse. By the year 2012, there will be 100 million people in the world living with HIV/AIDS, most of them teenagers, most of them women, most of them having got it related to drug use, prohibition-related drug problems. By then, we predict that the world's resources will not be able to survive, that there will be a collapse of security and all other resources. That is 6 years away. While we keep drug prohibition, the U.S. forces us to bring that date ever closer. Have they gone mad? Has the world gone mad? So our statement is, as Kirk mentioned in the introduction, this is about saving our children. It's about regulating drugs, getting them out of the hands of children. It is about stopping the spread of HIV, of hepatitis C. Canada is a peacemaking country. Let us make peace in the war on drugs and help the world to do so. Thank you.
You are listening to Century of Lies on the Drug Truth Network. And from Montreal, we are covering the International Drug Enforcement Counter Symposium. Next, we hear the formal remarks of Barrister Kirk Toussaint.
I'm acting chair of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association Drug Policy Committee, and I have an interesting perspective on this issue because I practiced law both in Vancouver and British Columbia as well as in the United States for 5 years, and so I have an understanding of both legal systems and the impact of the drug war on the legal system in the United States and what I see as the growing problem of the impact of the drug war on the system in Canada. The British Columbia Civil Liberties Association is Canada's premier civil liberties group. It has a 40-year history of taking a position on drug policy reform. It made one of its first submissions to the Levdane Commission in the early 1970s, considering the topic of marijuana policy reform, and it has taken the position that drug prohibition ought to be done away with in its submissions ever since then. Unfortunately, despite repeated studies of this issue, our Canadian policies remain virtually unchanged over the last 3 to 4 decades. This has carried tragic consequences for Canadian society. These consequences include the criminalization of over 1 million Canadians for the simple possession of marijuana, the increasing epidemic of HIV, AIDS, and Hep C among injection drug users, and the rise in prohibition-related crime, such as petty theft, money laundering, dangerously constructed indoor marijuana gardens in suburban basements, and the violence associated with a very lucrative black market in currently illegal substances. And make no mistake about it, these crimes are called by the DEA and other enforcement groups drug-related crimes, but they're not related at all to drugs. They're not caused by drugs. They're not caused by the use of drugs. They're caused by prohibition. And I think it's important that we be careful of the language we use. These are prohibition-related crimes. They exist solely because we prohibit certain currently illegal substances. Another victim of the war on drugs has been and continues to be the civil liberties and freedoms that are the very foundation of our Canadian democracy. I will speak today about two of these victims, individual autonomy and our democratic society. On a most fundamental level, laws that prohibit the use and possession of some drugs are an affront to the autonomy of all Canadians. It is emphatically not the role of government to dictate to the people what they should or should not put into their own bodies. It is my body. It is my choice. The paternalism inherent in the very idea of drug prohibition is repugnant to civil libertarians, and we reject emphatically the notion of the nanny state. Instead, civil libertarians believe, in the words of the Supreme Court of Canada in the Morgenthaler abortion law decision, and I quote, "The state will respect choices made by individuals and, to the greatest extent possible, will avoid subordinating these choices to any one conception of the good life," end quote. If an adult Canadian wants to smoke cannabis, use entheogenic substances such as peyote and mescaline, or even to inject heroin, the state has no right to make him or her a criminal for doing so. The right to criminalize only begins when the actions of the individual pose a direct and substantial risk of harm to others. Protecting someone from their own actions is simply not the proper function of the criminal law in a democratic society. And of course, the democratic society is another victim of the war on drugs. The essence of democracy is citizen participation. The participation in our collective societal debate is increasingly threatened by drug prohibition and its intended and unintended consequences. I think we see one of those consequences today in the refusal of both the DEA and the RCMP to come and be at this conference and to speak to us about their position. They don't want to talk to it because debate and discussion on this issue doesn't benefit their position at all. Debate and discussion on this issue reveals quite clearly that prohibition has been a failed policy and that we need to move in another direction. Those saddled with criminal records for possession, and in Canada and most countries mostly marijuana possession, have their travel rights jeopardized or eliminated, becoming prisoners in their own country. In the United States, citizens with felony drug convictions are denied the right to vote, the most basic democratic right of free citizens. In Canada, thanks to the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association and others, federal drug prisoners continue to retain the right to vote, but even this has come under attack from prohibitionist forces within government. Those Canadians who have developed problematic relationships with certain substances are increasingly in our society stigmatized and marginalized. The incredibly inflated costs of certain substances such as heroin and crack cocaine force people into theft, prostitution, and drug sales in order to finance expensive drug dependencies with negative ramifications for all Canadians. The drug-dependent person in our society has little ability to participate in democratic activity, and the spread of communicable diseases such as HIV/AIDS and Hep C has reached epidemic proportions in some Canadian cities and increasingly within prison. The growing trend towards co-opting municipal bylaw inspectors and utility providers into the drug war is also cause for concern for civil libertarians. We must be vigilant that we do not become a nation of informers. And we must resist the trend towards implementation of quasi-criminal municipal bylaws that encroach on our freedom and privacy in ever-increasing ways. BC Hydro and other hydro utilities should not be drafted into the war on drugs. They should not be reporting your private electrical consumption records to the RCMP. Stores should not be keeping lists of their customers so that they can turn them over to the police for further investigation. The tomato farmer and the cannabis farmer are both caught up in this web of privacy violations. There are, of course, many other negative consequences of the war on drugs and drug users, and I'm certain that the others gathered today to share their views will highlight these issues. Vigilance is required because the war on drugs, like any war on an amorphous idea, cannot be pursued without the diminishment of freedom. With no victim to complain to police, investigations into increasingly sophisticated drug distribution networks must utilize tools that place our civil liberties in extreme peril. No-knock searches, the use of high-tech tools that invade the privacy of our homes, confidential informants with incentives to fabricate stories in order to avoid excessive penalties, and the new government's proposed mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses. These are all tactics that are used to unjustly infringe upon the most basic fundamental freedoms and civil liberties of our Canadian society. Our opponents tell us that these ever-increasing intrusions into our autonomy and freedom are necessary in order to protect us from ourselves. And, as is so common, security is positioned as the alternative to freedom, and safety used to justify freedom's diminishment. We reject this false opposition and say clearly today that freedom and safety can not only coexist, but can thrive. By ending the societal scourge of drug prohibition and rejecting U.S. drug policy hegemony, we can make our communities safer, treat people more humanely, and protect and preserve the fundamental rights and freedoms that make Canada a strong and proud democracy. Thank you for your time and attention. For more information about the BCCLA or to join, please visit our website, bccla.org, and I encourage you to get involved and stay vigilant. Thank you very much.
Mr. Toussaint made note of the fact that U.S. policy, drug war policy, prevents many people from traveling abroad, and that's why this gray-haired reporter was not in Montreal to record this session. It seems that 35 years ago, I had a drug charge in Texas, and Canada will no longer allow me into their nation. But thank God, the reform organizations grow stronger every day. And I want to thank Tim Meehan of Ottawa, Canada, for the Canadian audio you're hearing on today's program. We'll be doing more of this over the coming weeks. Tim is with the National Capital Reformers Organization, educating us about the alternatives to the drug war at the municipal level. Their website is www.ncrefs.ca. Again, that is ncrefs.ca. Most weeks here on the Drug Truth Network, we get a report from Mr. Terry Nelson. He retired after 32 years' experience serving the U.S. government as a customs agent and border guard, and I'm proud to say he was chosen to speak at the conference in Montreal. I don't yet have that MP3. We'll probably be playing it next week. He just got back in the States last night, and I got a chance to talk to him about that Montreal conference.
This is Terry Nelson speaking. I just returned from Canada, where I attended the International Drug Enforcement Counter Symposium representing LEAP. Not a coincidence, the DEA was holding their annual conference in Montreal as well, and the hot topic during my stay in Canada was mandatory minimum sentences. As you're probably aware, the U.S. government has just finished twisting the arm of the new Canadian Prime Minister, and Canada is contemplating implementing mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses. Our symposium provided information as to how unsuccessful mandatory minimums have been in the United States. It has not been a successful deterrent at all, and we point out that the only thing mandatory minimums have done for the United States is to fill up our jails with mostly nonviolent offenders that have not committed a crime against another person, place, or thing. Their only offense is that they chose to live their lives by their own moral values and not those of the government. I was visiting the FBI website this morning, gathering a few facts for my presentation, and I wish to share a few of the drug war facts and figures with our listeners. From 1994 to 2003, the FBI figures show 15.5 million drug arrests, of which 1.9 million were juveniles. The data further reveal that in 1994, persons under 18 accounted for 11.8% of the number of arrests for drug abuse. 10 years later, the juvenile proportion of arrests for drug abuse violations was virtually unchanged. Now, this is from the FBI website. We have spent more than $1 trillion in the last 30 years and are spending an estimated $69 billion a year fighting this drug war. And there's been an increase of approximately 326,792 arrests in the last 10 years. I mean, that's added on to the yearly average. Drugs are more available, of higher quality, and cheaper than they were 30 years ago. The DEA reports that customers spend $65 billion a year purchasing illegal narcotics. These numbers alone make it a failed policy, without taking account the number of lives destroyed, the families that are broken up, and children that want no parents to raise them. Maintaining the current policies means that we will perpetuate the failure of our system year after year as these children reach adulthood, having had no positive role models, discipline, love, and guidance to assist them to mature properly. Our government needs to admit that the war was a big mistake and a failed foreign policy. All it has achieved is to enrich Asian warlords and terrorists, Colombian cartels, Mexican drug dealers, and an occasional politician. The policies of the failed war on drugs have succeeded in making construction prisons, private prisons, one of the fastest-growing business ventures in the United States. Does this sound like a strategy? Well, the answer is yes if you're building prisons, but no if you're a tax-paying citizen. LEAP does not encourage or approve of drug use, but we believe that prohibition did not work with alcohol, it is not working with drugs, and that the only sensible strategy is to legalize drugs, have the state produce, tax, and sell them, thus removing the profits from the terrorists, drug gangs, and cartels. We can then use that money to help people instead of hurting them. LEAP's mission is to reduce the multitude of unintended harmful consequences resulting from fighting the war on drugs, and to lessen the incidence of death, disease, crime, and addiction by ultimately ending drug prohibition. This is Terry Nelson on behalf of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, at www.leap.cc.
Now we turn our attentions back to the U.S. of A.
We're number one, and it feels like number two. The United States leads the world in prisons. 10 years ago, drug czar Barry McCaffrey warned that because of the drug war, we have created an American gulag. His words ring even truer today. According to the new World Prison Population List, just issued by the International Center for Prison Studies in England, the U.S. is the world's top jailer, closely followed by Communist China and the Russian Federation. According to the report, more than 9 million people are held in penal institutions throughout the world. Almost half of these are in three nations: the United States, with 2.09 million prisoners, China, with 1.55 million prisoners plus pretrial detainees and prisoners in administrative detention, and Russia, with 0.76 million. The U.S. also has the highest incarceration rate in the world. We lock up at least 714 of every 100,000 citizens. Second place is a three-way tie between Bermuda, Belarus, which was part of the former Soviet Union, and the Russian Federation, all at 532 per 100,000. The report notes that 58% of countries have incarceration rates below 150 per 100,000, including England and Wales, with a rate of 142, the Netherlands at 123, and Canada at 116. Canada may see its numbers creep up thanks to a newly elected conservative government, which is trying to import U.S.-style drug war policies, such as mandatory minimum sentences. However, a growing number of Canadians are protesting these moves, pointing out the failure of the U.S. system and noting that there are alternatives to prohibition. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org.
Well, we're done here, so once again I remind you there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, or medical data. There is, in fact, no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue. We've been duped. Please do your part to bring this madness to an end. Prohibido istac evilesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker, asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Guffman.